It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brown Eel. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, host Margot Patterson talks with Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center about hate crimes, hate groups, and why there are such designations. Then, in the second part of the show, host Ali Catherine Bush talks with Michael LaMotta, co-founder and president of Connecting for Good, about their mission to close the digital divide in Kansas City. Have your pens and papers ready for our calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news after the show. Up next is Margot and her guest, Mark Potok.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. People in the Kansas City area were shocked when in April a gunman shot and killed two people at the Jewish Community Center and another at the nearby Village Shalom retirement home in Overland Park, Kansas. The suspected killer, Frazier Glenn Miller, now facing trial for the murders, has a long history of involvement in extremist causes, was said to have shouted Heil Hitler when he was arrested, and was at one time the Grand Dragon of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan before being sued by the Southern Poverty Law Center for using intimidation tactics against African Americans and for forming an illegal paramilitary organization. The Southern Poverty Law Center monitors hate groups and domestic terrorism, and here today to talk about hate crimes legislation, and other activities of the center is Mark Potok, a senior fellow there. Mark Potok, welcome.
A pleasure to be here, Margo. Thanks for having me.
Going to the Southern Poverty Law Center's website, I was surprised by the range of hate groups that your center identifies and follows. The center lists anti-immigrant groups, black separatist groups, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, anti-government patriot groups, and others. How does the center decide what is a hate group? Is it a group's actions or their statements that you look at?
No, it's for us, hate groups are simply about the ideology of the group. In other words, does the group say that an entire group of human beings, based on their class characteristics, is somehow less? You know, we have some language on our website where we list these groups, where we say all hate groups have beliefs or practices that attack or malign an entire class of people, typically for their immutable characteristics. So, in other words, if you say, or your leader says, all white people are blue-eyed devils, all black people are criminal, all the Jews are whatever it may be. It's those kinds of statements that cause us to list these groups.
Who are the most common victims of hate crimes?
Well, in terms of frequency per capita, there's no question at all, based on quite a bit of work we've done here, that it is in fact the LGBT community. I think probably within that, transgender people are the most attacked. But that's very clear. They're attacked at something in terms of hate crimes, not just all kinds of violence, but in terms of hate crimes, at something like twice the rate of black Americans, four times the rate of Muslims and Jews, and it goes on from there.
What's the prevalence of hate crimes, and what are the most common hate crimes committed?
Well, it's an interesting question because the FBI National Hate Crime Statistics have shown since they began publishing these numbers back in 1992 annual totals of something around 6,000 to around 10,000 a year nationally, depending on the year, and the number kind of bounces up and down. All of us in the field thought that those numbers were low, but of course that was not provable for a long time. However, in the last several years, there's something called the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is a unit within the Department of Justice, has done three major and very important studies. And while the methodology is fairly complicated, the upshot is that the real number of hate crimes in America is almost 260,000 a year, which is remarkable. In other words, it's something like 25 to 45 times higher than the national FBI statistics suggest.
And what are some of the crimes that would be committed? I mean, what would the spectrum be?
Well, what hate crimes really are not a freestanding class of crimes that aren't like any others. In most states, hate crime laws are simply penalty enhancements they come in the sentencing phase of other crimes. So you might be charged with aggravated battery or assault or murder or vandalism, say, of a synagogue or whatever it may be. Typically, under these statutes, say you were going to, you would normally get maybe, say, 5 years for aggravated assault. If it's charged as a hate crime, and if the jury agrees, that sentence might double, or even in some cases triple. It's not usually that much high, but the sentence gets longer if the crime is found to be motivated by hatred of a particular group.
So, if I asked you what the most common hate crime committed would be, would really just be what the most common crime is?
That's right. I'm not sure I know absolutely the answer, but I'm sure that it's various kinds of assault, all the way from simple assault to aggravated battery.
I'm wondering if you could bring us up to date about the case of Frazier Glenn Miller. At the time he was arrested, it was reported that he would likely be charged with a federal hate crime on top of the murder charge he faces. Do you know if that's going forward, and what would the reasoning be, since if he was convicted of murder, he'd go to jail for the rest of his life, possibly face the death penalty? What's the rationale for then prosecuting him on a hate crime charge?
Well, I don't think he is being prosecuted on hate crime charges. He is being prosecuted on murder and capital murder. And, you really made the point in your question. If you're being tried for capital murder and you're convicted, there's not much people can do to you that's worse than, putting you in the executioner's chamber. So very often those kinds of things, there's really no point in charging it as a hate crime. There is a point for some people. Sometimes the victims in the community or the families of the victims very much want these things prosecuted as hate crimes just to make it clear to the world what was really at work in the murder or the assault of their loved ones. However, as a prosecutorial matter, proving hate crimes is more difficult often than simply proving the crime, because at the end of the day, what you're trying to show is not merely that in this case Miller murdered three people, but that he was, what was in his mind? Why did he carry out those murders? And sometimes that's rather difficult to show. In his case, it probably wouldn't be. I mean, it's a fact that he yelled Heil Hitler immediately after the shooting, so that was televised by a local camera crew. In any case, I don't think in this case it'd make much difference one way or the other.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and if you're just tuning in, my guest is Mark Potok, a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. I had not known until I did a little research that hate crime legislation dates back to the Civil Rights Act of 1871, when, following the Civil War, during Reconstruction, racially motivated crimes in the South were committed by the Ku Klux Klan. The modern era for hate crime legislation seems to have begun, about 100 years later. The first penalty enhancement statute was passed in California in 1978. Since then, 45 states and the District of Columbia have statutes criminalizing various types of hate crimes. What is the argument for adding penalties to the punishments that already exist for murders, assaults, robberies, vandalism, and other crimes?
Well, that's a very good question, and oftentimes you will hear critics, particularly on the political right, saying, we're punishing thought. It's un-American. I would very much disagree with that. I mean, the logic of enhancing penalties for hate crimes as opposed to other crimes is a couple of things. One, the idea that there are more victims than the immediate people who are attacked. So if you, say, attack black family that has moved into a largely white neighborhood, say, or you plant a burning cross on the lawn of an interracial couple, those kinds of things do not merely attack the immediate victims. They make every other black person in that state or in that area who's living in white neighborhoods afraid. It makes every other interracial couple in the neighborhood afraid. They are being terrorized. So these are essentially acts of terrorism. They're designed not merely to intimidate and frighten and hurt the immediate victims, but they have the effect of really terrorizing a much larger community. The other, I think, important justification is the idea that hate crimes, unlike most other crimes, tend to split communities along pre-existing fault lines. In other words, you know, American communities in general do have problems with race relations and so on, and these crimes exacerbate those problems and really split entire communities in very devastating ways. You know, one other way of thinking about this is that we do, in fact, in American law, in many instances, punish people for motive, not merely for what they actually did. So, for instance, say a person is found on my porch, you know, trespassing on my land, having walked onto my lot, and he's now on the porch, and the cops come, and he's arrested. Well, you know, it would be one thing if what he was really doing was taking a shortcut across the corner lot in order to get home, you know, 3 minutes earlier. However, if the police found in his pocket a set of burglary tools, the charge would be entirely different. It would be attempted burglary because it would be clear by that evidence that his intention was not merely to walk across the corner of my lot. You know, in the same way, you might think about the way the murders of police officers are treated. If someone kills you or I walking down the streets, in most states, the killer might get, say, 15, 20 years, something like that. However, if you or I were a police officer and were killed in this very same circumstances, chances are excellent the person would get the death penalty. And that is because we as a society have decided that the police are the quote-unquote thin blue line. They are people who take risks every day in order to protect the rest of us, and we as a society have a very high interest in protecting those individuals.
Well, I'm sure some people might raise questions about having such very harsh penalties for police officers, but going back to your first point about how you can terrorize an entire community, I have no trouble believing that you can, but you could say that about crime in general. I mean, you get enough... You know, if you had enough murders going on in a particular neighborhood, even if they weren't racially motivated, they would terrorize that neighborhood.
Well, in a sense, that's right, but it's that terror applies to everyone equally, and that's not true. If the murderer, the attacker, whatever it may be, is only going after, say, gay men. You know, it's typically a specific demographic that's being attacked and terrorized. So it seems to me a little more pointed and a little more threatening than simply, you know, you happen to live in a city that has a very high crime rate right now and it's not terribly safe out there.
What do you say to people who say, given the very large number of Americans incarcerated in our country, a greater percentage of the population serving time in prison than in any other country, why lock people up for even longer, particularly when penalties in this country are pretty stiff as is, and most people, when they do serve time, are serving longer sentences than in other countries?
Well, I think that's a legitimate argument to make. I would argue that in the case of young people, certainly first offenders with respect to hate crimes, it is a real mistake generally to send them to prison or even to jail. And the reason, well, especially prison, the reason is that our prison system is extremely racialized. And particularly younger people going into prisons often find it necessary to join racist prison gangs in order to protect themselves. So, you know, if you're a white kid going into prison, you may very well feel pressured and your fears would not be out of place to join a white prison gang so that you will not be, say, terrorized or raped or shaken down by black inmates. And the same is true for black kids going into the prison system. So, you know, for younger offenders, I think what often happens is we see these kids who are perhaps angry, maybe they're acting out with respect to problems in their own family and so on. You know, they may have some racist feelings, but they're not committed racists. Well, you know, when they come out of prison, sometimes they really are committed racists. You know, now they have racist tattoos all over their body. They've been schooled up in the ideology of, you know, why black people are our enemy and so on and so on. In the case of older people, you know, I think the argument you're making is perhaps better made. I think that, you know, you really can go back and forth about that. The reason, I think it's probably very doubtful that hate crime penalty enhancements really lower the level of crime. I think that very few people, before they, you know, sock somebody in the face, really think about whether they're going to get 6 months or whether it's going to be 9 months. However, it's a way of society saying, sort of out loud, that this is important. These crimes are really destructive of our society, and we're paying attention. So in a sense, it's symbolic.
Well, a couple of questions. When you say it's a way of society saying out loud these crimes are important, does it then, if there's no deterrent value, does it then simply become an expression of liberal self-righteousness?
One could argue about that, and I don't know that they have no deterrent value. I know there are people who do work similar to what I do, who are in the kind of anti-hate business, who believe that they really are effective. I'm not sure there's ever really been a serious study, any kind of scholarly study, that has shown it to be one way or the other. It has really proven the case one way or the other. I guess I just have to leave it there. I'm really not sure.
You mentioned how you think it would be a mistake to lock a young person up for a crime motivated by some kind of animus against a particular group. In my mind, I have this idea of the common person committing a hate crime as being young. But is that a misconception on my part?
No, it's true. It is the same group of young men that commit most crimes in general. I don't know the precise ages, but, like 14 to 24, that range. It's typically men, it's typically young men. But that's no more or less true for hate crimes than it is for any other kind of crime, barring a few special categories like financial crimes.
Is there any concern that penalty enhancements for hate crimes creates a backlash against the people they are intended to protect? That people may perceive that some people get special treatment under the law, that we aren't all equal, and that some people are a lot more equal than others?
Well, I haven't heard that argument much made in the political mainstream. However, it is commonly made on the far right among the white supremacist groups who really go on quite a bit along just those lines, that white people are the real victims. The politically correct have kind of seized control of the society, and they, meaning Aryans, as they would call themselves, are the real victims, are the people who are really being discriminated against.
I know that the Matthew Shepard Act made sexual identity a protected category. Is gender a protected category, given that crimes against women are certainly very common?
Under the Matthew Shepard Act, yes, but under very few other state statutes. It's a dicey proposition because once you head down that road, it is possible, at least theoretically it seems to me, to say that, say, every sexual assault of a woman is a hate crime. And I think at that point, we're beginning to lose the meaning of what the writers of these laws had in their heads at the beginning. In any case, I don't think there have been very, very rare prosecutions of that sort.
And in terms of prosecuting crimes as hate crimes, is the bar for evidence pretty high, or is anybody who attacks a member of a certain group liable to be suspected of committing a hate crime?
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think that these are very tough cases to make. There's a huge amount of interracial crime, obviously, in the country, and most of it is not quote-unquote hate crime. Obviously things differ from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction in terms of how cases are tried. But I think it's tough, and I think prosecutors shy away, as a general matter, from hate crime prosecutions simply because it adds a whole dimension of proof that is tough to get to, the idea of, what was in this person's mind. Sometimes the cases are incredibly simple. The classic hate crime is, the man who walks into a bar and says to the person on the stool next to him, starts to talk about how he hates, say, black people, and then walks out of that bar, and the first black person who walks by is murdered by this guy, someone, a complete stranger killing. That's quite an obvious case. But usually, from a legal point of view, the facts are not so clean. It's not so easy. So I think that is why, very often, crimes that probably are hate crimes are not, in fact, prosecuted that way. Another very good example is, for instance, there have been an awful lot of armed robberies of undocumented Latino immigrants. And I've seen several instances in which this argument has played out. Are they being attacked and terrorized because the robbers you look down on, hate, despise Latinos? Or is it simply that they're undocumented and they're vastly less likely to go to the police and get you in trouble?
The Southern Poverty Law Center was founded in 1971. How has the work of the center changed, and how have hate groups changed, if at all, since the senator began monitoring them? Have you seen new types of groups spring up?
Well, first to the first question, I mean, we, our work early on was, the very first work of the center was just kind of classic civil rights law firm work. We worked on cases having to do with, say, voter dilution, you know, voting rights cases with a racial angle, the kinds of things that many other people were doing. In the early 80s, Morris Dees, the co-founder of the center, brought our first civil suit against a Klan group, and that really was, legally speaking, a genuinely pioneering case. The idea of suing these groups and their leaders for the actions of their members, even when the leaders did not know in advance what the members were going to do, was quite novel. So that became certainly what the center was most famous for. Back then, in the 70s, early 80s, this was a very small operation. There were probably four or five lawyers and a few other people. You know, today we're almost 250 people, and the work has expanded very greatly. In my own department, we cover all kinds of hate groups, as you talked about at the very beginning of the show. We also have a very large teaching tolerance department, which works with schools all over the country to do just what the name suggests. These are K-12 schools. And our legal department is into all kinds of different issues now. We're doing a lot of work on having to do with immigration, with exploitation of foreign workers in this country, with kids, particularly in deep South schools, particularly black kids, being very quickly put into prison for, you know, minor offenses and that kind of thing. So there's the work has very much expanded in a number of different directions. How have the groups changed? Well, you know, one thing that did not exist at the time the center began were the so-called militia groups. The groups call themselves patriot groups. And this whole world of groups that believes the federal government is the real enemy, that the federal government is secretly conspiring to kind of enslave the American people and destroy their liberties and force us into a one-world government, so-called, the so-called New World Order, that's all fairly new. And, I mean, the roots of those groups go back into the 70s and 60s, but the actual militia movement really didn't appear until the 90s.
Before
and then we have all these new kinds of groups, like anti-Muslim groups, are a fairly new phenomenon in the last 10 years or so.
Before we close, could you say just a little bit about the Sovereign Citizens Movement, which is a subset of these anti-government groups that you've spoken of? I was very interested to read about them and knew nothing about them.
Well, it's a very bizarre movement. As you say, it's a subset of the Patriot Movement. These are people specifically who believe that the federal government has no authority over them in terms of criminal or tax laws. They typically don't believe that they have to pay any taxes. They typically believe that the government has no right to regulate their passage on the roads. In other words, no government can demand driver's licenses or auto insurance or car registrations and so on. They also engage in all kinds of very strange filings in court, filings that have no basis in the real legal system, but which have the effects of gumming up the courts. The whole thing, when you really get into the incredibly convoluted theories that sovereign citizens have, would be almost funny because they're so ridiculous, some of their theories about the government, were it not for the fact that a hefty number of sovereign citizens have engaged in really serious criminal violence. You know, just one case I think of immediately is May 20th of 2010, when a sovereign citizen father and son were pulled over in West Memphis, Arkansas by police doing a routine stop on the interstate there. These guys got out of their van. They handed what was supposedly their car registration to the officers, but was in fact this strange document filled with sovereign citizen language that the cops just couldn't understand. You can actually see them on the dash cam looking at this and looking puzzled. And at that very moment, these two men, well, actually the son jumps out of the car that's being stopped with an AK-47 and murders the two officers. We've seen quite a number of those killings of law officers by sovereign citizens. That is without a doubt why the FBI has described the sovereign citizen movement as a domestic terrorist movement.
Mark, before we close, is there a website that you'd like to give for the Southern Poverty Law Center? If people have questions, is there
sure.
any
I,
place
people are welcome to look at our website. We have two things that may interest people. We have about 15 years of archives of investigative stories that have been published in the magazine I edit, the Intelligence Report. And we also have a map, an interactive hate group map, which I think is of very high interest to many people. You can click on your state and see what are the active groups in your state, where are they located, what are their names, what type of groups they are, and that sort of thing. The website is www.splcenter.org, splcenter.org.
Mark, thank you so much for talking to us about the Southern Poverty Law Center.
A real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
And now the calendar for June 23rd. You are invited to the ACLU of Missouri's annual meeting, Saturday, June 28th, at their St. Louis office. This is the meeting where the members elect the directors and board members to oversee their affiliate. Attendees will also receive an update on the work of the ACLU of Missouri. The 2014 annual meeting is open to the public, Saturday, June 28th. From 1 to 3 p.m., 454 Witter Street, St. Louis, Missouri, 63108. They ask that you RSVP to DREAD at aclu-mo.org. Light refreshments will be served. Children of incarcerated parents will have a summer food program that will start Monday, June 30th. Their harvesters, Kids Cafe will serve all children ages 18 and younger free nutritious meals. Also, free meals will be provided to individuals ages 18 to 21 that are determined by a state agency to be physically or mentally disabled. Lunch will be served Monday through Friday from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. and dinner 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. at 6285 Paseo, Kansas City, Missouri. If you have any questions regarding this program, please call 816-517-9504. Here is a quick update to the food sharing ordinance. We spoke to Richard Tripp about a couple of weeks ago. After more than an hour of debate on the city council floor and a failed attempt to send the ordinance back to the committee, the ordinance was voted down. It had become clear that neither those opposed or those for the ordinance would be changing their votes. It is unclear if the ordinance will be amended and reintroduced. My name is Keith Brown-Eal. These events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
Good morning. This is Allie Catherine Bush, your host today for Jaws of Justice. I have a guest today. His name is Michael Liamita. I'm sorry, Michael Liamita.
Limita.
Limita, I'm sorry. You are the co-founder and the chief executive officer for this organization. And that organization is called
Connecting for Good.
Okay. And we also have a website for people, once we do the interview, where they can contact you for information about the computers. And would you tell us what your motto is? And again, I just want to say this is Jaws of Justice, Community Radio 90.1 FM. So tell us about your mission.
Connecting for Good is the only Kansas City organization whose primary mission is to close the digital divide. We really believe that helping people who are unconnected become connected is probably the most important social justice issue of our day, especially because, you know, you need to be online not just to, you know, check your Facebook or email, but it's also the key to finding employment, and education, two things that have a huge impact on people's ability to be self-sustaining and to see our communities develop. So we have a three-pronged approach, and it really makes us very unique among anybody in the whole country who's doing this work. The first is that we are a wireless ISP, and we are involved with bringing internet to low-income communities. Currently, we provide four low-income housing projects with free internet, and that's about 500 or 600 families who are getting it right now. We're also involved with outreach through community computing centers, and we have one that we opened in March on 3rd Street in Kansas City, Kansas. It has a 20-seat public access computer center, and we also do classes that we call our free digital life skills classes. In the last year, we've actually had about 1,000 individuals take these classes, learning basic skills like email, web browsing, and then when they do take the class, they're able to buy a very, very inexpensive computer. We provide that because we have our own refurbishing operations, where we can provide these computers for very, very inexpensive.
Okay, you do have people of all ages, seniors, high school kids, and low-income people. So these are people that you really are able to serve.
Yeah, it's anybody who's not online. And, of course, if you really follow who's not using the Internet today, you find out that, you know, a huge percentage of these families are in a lower income category of under $20,000 a year. Also you find many who are senior citizens, disabled, and families who live in low-income housing. We did a study of the last year or so and discovered that 75% of the people we serve are women. Of them, 80% live under $20,000 a year in income.
Okay.
75% of them are also minorities. And interestingly enough, we found that over half of the class participants over 60 have a child living with them that's under 18 years old.
Okay.
So it's interesting because there's the phenomenon, especially in the inner city, where grandchildren oftentimes are living with the grandma, and we're finding many of them really want to get a computer in the home and want to learn about the Internet for the sake of the kids that they're caring for.
Okay, it's almost like having telephone service, but it's more enhanced.
Well, really, we actually have three core values at Connecting for Good. The first one is we believe that connectivity equals opportunity. It's a digital society, and to fully participate in a digital society, you have to be digital yourself.
Right.
So, and it's not just going to the public library to wait for 2 hours to use a computer for 45 minutes. It's having a connection in your home where you can access it and use it as long as you want, especially for the sake of being able to have, do schoolwork or do job searches or search for medical information.
Right.
I mean, the whole Social Security system is moving to an online format. I mean, their goal is that all new Social Security applicants would be doing it online.
Okay. When I was looking at your organization on the Internet, on your website, Connecting for Good, I was trying to understand how does this work, connecting up these different neighborhoods? I think you mentioned Google Fiber. Is that part of how it gets all connected?
Well, actually, we actually buy the Internet wholesale ourselves.
Okay.
So Connecting for Good is a nonprofit that is a wireless Internet service provider.
Okay.
We discovered that for us, the most cost-effective way to do it is to buy it wholesale.
Okay.
And we then are building a network, a backbone in Kansas City, using open source software and dishes that look a lot like Dish Network dishes, except rather than looking at satellites, the dishes look at each other. We use a technology called AirMax and AirFiber, which is a point-to-point microwave signal. And we've set these dishes on several buildings throughout town to create the backbone. And then in low-income housing communities like Juniper Gardens or Posada del Sol, we set up what are called mesh networks. And those are several radios that broadcast Wi-Fi. And they actually are unique because a mesh network, the radios talk to each other, and so the signal is transferred from radio to radio, looking back to the microwave access point.
Okay. Could you tell us about Rosedale Ridge, their story, your success there?
Yeah, we actually, our first real public project was to bring the wireless connections to Rosedale Ridge, which is at 2 Mill Street in Kansas City, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 168-unit Section 8 property. And we basically did it originally with just our donated equipment and volunteers. And it provides, and has been running now for a year and a half, provides about 168 families with free internet. When we first went there, of course, we found that 80% of the families had no in-home internet. The biggest reason is because, you know, it's a place where people make an average of $10,000 a year.
Okay.
We found, you know, even though Kansas City, Kansas provides, you know, these laptops that the students could use during the school year, we only found one kid in that complex who could use their laptop.
Oh, my goodness.
Because there's no in-home connections there.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, in Kansas City, Missouri, it's very tragic that we know 70% of the students in the school district don't have in-home internet on this side of the state line. But in Rosedale Ridge, in the first month of turning it on, we had over 50 families there go through the classes that we offered. They picked up this cheap computer, and you know, now we have over 200 unique devices connecting to the internet. And of those, we can see 20, 25 of them every month are the school district-issued laptops that are being used.
Okay, and how do you identify these neighborhoods or people that need a computer?
Well, it's actually twofold. I mean, on one side, as far as where do we bring the wireless internet, It has a lot to do with partners. We work with, you know, different nonprofits who say, we'd like to bring this to our neighborhood, or we'd like to bring this to our building. So when a neighborhood or a property says to us, you know, come and tell us what it would take to do this, we will go out and we have done several feasibility studies to find out the exact cost. Because, I mean, the biggest investment is when you first go in and you put up several radios. And that, like the whole concept that we did at Juniper Gardens was about a $40,000 equipment cost.
Okay.
But over time, once you get the equipment installed in a multifamily dwelling, the cost to provide the bandwidth is less than $10 a year per family.
That's really good.
Yeah. And on the other side, to work with people in terms of bringing them into our classes. It's really open to the public. We don't charge anything for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we want people to learn how to use the internet. We also have a mobile computing lab that we can take out to different facilities, different you know, events that we can also do the training there.
Okay. Are there some other areas that, well, not areas, but are there any other success stories that have just happened recently or is ongoing?
Yeah, there are some examples of what has happened.
Uh-huh.
You know, one of the things with seniors especially is they can end up feeling very isolated. You know, many of them, their families have moved away.
Mm-hmm.
And so one way for them to connect with the outside world is to get them online. And we have many who have told us once they've gotten a very inexpensive computer from us that, they were able to get on Facebook or Skype and stay in touch with their children and their grandchildren in ways that they never could before. And that's a huge thing to have that outside contact. But we've had many situations where adults, even over 50, who have begun to use the computer and have had the connections, actually rediscovered their love of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And they have
mm-hmm.
gone on to complete their GEDs, which is pretty cool. And we have one example of a young lady in her 20s who was a single mom living on a public assistance, just very frustrated with her life. And we helped her to, get online. We helped her then to work with her resume. And that led to, even talking to her about how to dress mm-hmm. for success. She did get a job eventually and actually finished her GED and went on to enroll in an online college. And all that happened in just about a 9-month span.
Okay, well, I just want to mention again this morning that I'm Allie Catherine Bush, the host on Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Michael
Limita.
Limita, thank you again. The organization is Connecting for Good. And I just want to say, if you've just tuned in, this is KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. We're going to speak again with Michael and talk about how you can contact him and his headquarters location in Kansas City, Missouri, and also the community Wyandotte Community Center in Kansas City, Kansas. So, Michael, tell us what your location is in Missouri.
Yes, we're located at 31st and Troost, 3101 Troost, and that's where we have our headquarters. It's also where we do our free digital life skills classes at 10 a.m. every Thursday and Friday. Then our community technology center is located at North 3rd Street, 2006, in Kansas City, Kansas, and that's where we have our public access computer lab and do the same classes every Tuesday and Wednesday at 12:30. And, we find a lot of folks who have never used the internet or even a computer are getting involved with this. Our last survey, we discovered that 25% of those who come to our classes have never even touched a computer. So it's a big deal for them. And I think a lot of it is there's kind of like an intimidation factor.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of older people, have never experienced a computer and have always thought it was so difficult,
mm-hmm.
so complicated, so expensive. And so we have worked to try to find out ways to get people devices for very cheap, to find the best way to get connected to a computer and into the internet. And I know for me, I have a kind of a core notion that if I put you in front of an internet-connected computer and you know what to do,
mm-hmm.
the world is just wide open to you.
Right.
And in our situation, as I said before, there are so many barriers to connecting, and our job is just, our focus is to say, how do we create a situation where the barriers to entry are lower, I was talking about our core values before, and one of them is that connectivity equals opportunity, and that really is tied to it. I put you in front of an internet connected computer, and the world is suddenly open to you. It's a door
right.
to the universe.
Oh.
Our second value is that really education is the number one thing that lifts people from poverty.
Right.
And it's not possible to obtain a quality education today without internet access. And that's why we see, especially on the Missouri side, where 70% of the kids in the school district don't have internet at home.
Mm-hmm.
It's tragic when you think of some of the surrounding suburbs where it's 90, 95, 99% home internet use. So we really are trying to tackle that 70% number by being creative with wireless. And the third thing then that we're talking about is we really believe, like you said earlier, that the internet should be a necessary public utility.
Right.
That it's just as essential as telephone, electricity, and running water. And having that as the third, you know, or the fifth, you might say, public utility is, you know, essential for this modern era. There's a huge growing segment of our population, I think, that's being left out because they cannot connect.
Okay, so the best solution then is to tell all our friends and have them to do whatever they can, volunteer, or go and get the training themselves, or to donate computers that can be refurbished.
Yes, we'll take money and we'll take computers. And, you know, another important part of what we do, too, is serve nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very talented staff of people in the IT realm.
Mm-hmm.
And they are involved with setting up computer labs, installing Wi-Fi at nonprofits. And we have a special deal for nonprofits right now because XP is going out to give them a Windows 7 tower.
Okay. They're
very, very cheap, and I understand I can't say the price on the air,
mm-hmm.
but if people go to connectmeforgood.org, they can find out what that price is.
Okay. What is the website?
It's connectingforgood.org.
Okay.
And our Twitter account is at ConnectingKC.
Okay. You also gave me this morning a brochure on City Vision College. Tell us a little bit about that and how that connects up with the computer education.
Right. Well, actually, I'm the chief academic officer for City Vision College. Our website is cityvision.edu, and it is an online college that I was actually involved in starting back in 1998. So my involvement with online learning goes back that far. The school is really designed for working adults who've taken a lot of college but never put their degree together. So it's probably one of the few private colleges in America where you can get mm-hmm. a full year of school for $6,000.
Okay.
We also have a network of organizations that provide internships, and they are actually tuition-paid internships where if you work at one of the organizations that is participating in the program, they will pay your tuition. The three programs of City Vision College are Urban Missions, which helps people to work social programs, spiritual programs in the inner city. The second is Nonprofit Administration, which is all about the business end of nonprofits. And the third is Addiction Studies, and that's our biggest program where people are prepared to become addiction counselors online.
Okay, and the degree after completion, what is that?
We have a BA in Urban Missions, a Bachelor of Science in Nonprofit Management, and a Bachelor of Science in Addiction Studies. And with the Addiction Studies program, we're actually an approved educational provider for NADAC, which is the National Association of Alcohol and Drug Counselors. And that basically means kind of we have double certification, both the fact that we're accredited and then have the NADAC approval so that all of our classes can be used for continuing education and meet the education qualifications of both Missouri and Kansas.
Okay. To help people get enrolled, what is the first step? What do they do?
Cityvision.edu is the school, and our number is 816. I don't call it. I'm sorry. 816-960-2008.
You don't call yourself.
Right. But 816-960-2008.
Okay, and the website if they want to
cityvision.edu.
Okay.
Right. And so we're a Missouri-based education. Our student body is spread across the U.S. as well as our faculty. And we are accredited by the Distance Education and Training Council, which is recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. So People can use veterans benefits, and we provide, you know, federal student aid as far as loans and Pell Grants, that sort of thing.
Okay. You have given us some very good information this morning to help people all over the Kansas City area. And I just wanted to thank you for being our guest and coming in. Again, would you give us your website for Connecting for Good?
Yes, it's connectingforgood.org. Simple to remember, or calm as well.
Okay. And anyone that wants to contribute or donate to the organization?
It's possible to do that online.
Okay.
It is.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being on the show today. And we hope that people will contact you immediately.
Yeah, we're excited. I think folks are beginning to know about us and mm-hmm. know what we do, and we're inviting the community to be part of it. You know, we contract and partner with a lot of different community agencies, and because ultimately we believe there are very few things that can transform a person's life as immediately as being on the internet.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much again for coming on the show today. We appreciate the information and hope people will take advantage of it. Thank you so much.
I might appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ready? One, two, three. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Jessica Thomas, host of Before the Dawn on Sunday morning from 4 to 7 a.m. Our outro music is Better Man from the Plan for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beauticious Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Following segment comes out of Pennsylvania, courtesy WHTM.
While Pennsylvania still hasn't legalized medical marijuana,
the federal government has been giving it to a man with bone tumors for years. Kendra Nichols is here now with the details. Kendra. Well, that man testified at a hearing today for Senate Bill 1182 at the Capitol. And during that hearing, he actually held up a can filled with medical marijuana cigarettes, and he told the senators that the medicine saved his life.
We need to pass a law to take away the crime from it.
While many people in Pennsylvania are fighting.
And here's a vape pen with my oil in it, so I can do that in, you know, this room.
For legal access to medical marijuana.
And that's how I get my medicine.
This man has been getting it from the federal government.
Then I roll each day what I need.
For the past 31 years.
It's difficult because the federal government does not want people to understand that they are giving it out. And so they've really kind of kept it quiet.
The federal government was testing this for medicinal use while it was a Schedule I drug?
Correct. Isn't that ironic?
Rosenfeld was one of many people who testified in front of the Law and Justice Committee in support of Senate Bill 1182, which would legalize medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. The federal government sends Rosenfeld a tin filled with 300 medical cannabis cigarettes every month.
But the federal government says that its Schedule I has no medical benefit, which is hypocrisy, because here it is, they've been giving it to me for this long, and I'm doing fantastic. I'm very fortunate.
Rosenfeld has a severe bone tumor disorder.
I've not had a tumor grow or a new one develop since I was 21, and I'm 61 years old.
And the hypocrisy has to end. That has to end.
Senator Mike Fulmer, co-sponsor of the bill, says it's time to see some action.
This is ridiculous. I mean, we're supposed to be compassionate people. We're supposed to be, you know, about the quality of life. I was told, Mike, here, you're a conservative Christian. Why are you doing this? I'm doing this because I am a conservative Christian, because I do believe in the quality of life.
So what happens next? Senator Fulmer says he wants to push this bill for a vote to get it out of committee and to the Senate floor. Fulmer tells us he believes he has the votes in the Senate to pass this bill. Working for you in Harrisburg, I'm Kendra Nichols, ABC 27 News. Back to you.
And Kendra, you can see Fulmer is very passionate about this issue.
Yeah, I mean, he just returned from that trip to Colorado, so he met a lot of people, you know, real people out there that are using this medicine, and it's changing their lives. I have to say, he probably feels a little frustrated coming back here and seeing what it could possibly or potentially do for people, and it's just not legal here.
Be interesting to see the outcome. Thank you, Kendra. Medical marijuana is legal in 22 states.
Again, they were speaking to my good friend, Mr. Irvin Rosenfeld, gets 300 joints every month, courtesy of the federal government. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.